Good evening. Welcome to Tate Modern. My name is Gabriela Salgado. I'm curator of public programs, and I'm standing next to Patricia Vickers, the editor of Art Monthly. This season of Talking Art that you might know from before starts with an amazing treat. We have John Baldessari here with us tonight. And it is a really special event because we normally do these talks after the show's open, but this one is before the show opens. So this is an absolute treat. Thank you, John, for coming. And I will not say anything about John now because Patricia will introduce the talk. I just ask you, please, to switch off your mobile phones and also to wait for the microphone when the questions come, because we are recording this on video and we would like everything to be coming clear and on the video. Thank you very much. Bye.
Thank you very much, Gabriela. As she said, this is the third series, so welcome, and we're very proud that we're kicking it off with John Baldessari talking to Simon Patterson. What can one say about John Baldessari? Actually, he's now at last receiving almost every award, including the Golden Lion in Venice for Lifetime Achievement. But I particularly like the fact that he was awarded the inaugural baccalaureate. We were trying to figure out earlier what it actually stood for, BACA. I think it's the Bonifanten Award for Contemporary Art. But the important thing is that one of the judges, Robert Storr, who will be known to many of you, described it as a prize for artists' artists. And that's overwhelmingly what John Baldessari is. So many artists owe him respect as well as influence. And it's in because of that that we originally interviewed him many years ago with Liam Gillick, and this time with Simon Patterson, because it seems right that artists should talk to John. And Simon is a good choice because we vividly remember the 1993 Venice Aperto, the last Aperto proper. And we saw John, who can hardly be missed, at the other end of the Corderia, walking towards us, and Simon was then showing the two Last Suppers, arranged according to the flatback four formation, Jesus Christ in Goal, and the sweeper formation, Jesus Christ in Goal. And John walked towards Simon and said, "Jesus Christ is exactly my height." And Simon said, "Of course." So enjoy.
Welcome, John. Welcome to London. I'm sorry to sort of go back to the beginning, or near the beginning, with your work, but I sort of thought I'd like to start with asking you about the cremation piece, which was from Cremation Project, I beg your pardon, which is from 1970.
Well, a little earlier, 68.
68, I beg your pardon. But that's, am I right in saying that coincided with you moving out of your studio that was...
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that was a movie theatre, wasn't it?
It was a vacant movie theatre, yeah. Yes.
Was this one that your father had...
He had built it, and then television, you know, became really popular, and movies not so popular. And then it was a lost cause, and it was vacant, and I asked if I could use it as a studio.
But the reason I sort of wanted to ask you about cremation piece was twofold, really. The piece, if I can get the title right here, sorry. The back of all the trucks passed from Los Angeles to Santa Barbara. Now, that was a work from 63, is that right?
I think
right?
So, yeah, about in there, yeah.
Did you cremate that? That's what I was wondering.
No, because that wasn't a painting.
Yeah.
But they were photographs.
And, I see. So you sort of...
What I did was sort of... seal off my past, you know. I guess I painted for maybe 20, 23 years, something like that. And then they were all in these, people didn't sell, I mean, artists didn't sell works back then, and maybe, you know, a few friends trading things, that sort of thing, mother-in-law, but selling, no. And, you know, painting, and I was in this movie theater, and I damn near had it filled up. You know, I mean, you know, if I spread them all out and everything. So I had this idea that if I were going to go on being a painter, I would be inundated. And number one, And two, did I really have to own them? You know, because, you know, it was an experience that I, and I learned a lot with each painting. I had them in my mind. I even had photographs of them. So did I really physically have to own them? So that obtained in my decision. And then the other one was that I had this growing sneaky suspicion I was on the wrong path. I was taught art, as it was taught in that period, pretty much painting and sculpture. And I had this idea, yes, that was okay, but art might be more than that. And of course, a lot of people through the world who are getting the same uneasy feeling about the same time. So I decided to be reductive and shrink everything, in some way, metaphorically. My first idea was that I was going to change the photographs into micro dots and put them under stamps and mail them out to my artist friends, kind of like James Bond. And I said, well, that's kind of labor intensive. So but he wanted a really reductive idea of somehow atomizing things. Yeah. And then I thought, well, if I could, return them to dust, that sort of thing, So I said, yeah, well, I'll just burn them all. That idea grew on me because then I thought, well, some sort of eternal return. Mm. The pigments come out of the earth and some point here it becomes the painting and they go back, you go back, right? So, and then I got that far and then I decided, well, then, I'll push it further, as some symbolic act. And I'll actually go to a crematorium and have them cremated, taking that idea of a body of work seriously. Mm. Little hard to find anyone, but I guess I found a crematorium in a low rent district that needed the business, and they said they would do it at night, which kind of like that. And it got really eerie at that point, of course. And the guy doing the crematorium, he was doing the actual cremating, he was really into it because he had gone to art school. And so, what more can you ask?
I mean, was it, it's the sort of thing that I think most artists would like to do, when they're presented with that situation of something, what do you do with all this stuff that you kind of accumulate? And but you, do you objects or materials that you think, should I turn that into a work or do I just throw it out?
I didn't think it was so much, I still don't think of it as art now, it's just something I did and that's the residue.
But as a sort of, clearinghouse.
Which you call them storage solutions.
Yes, yeah. Or these days, the storage company will probably just burn down anyway.
Exactly. Yeah.
You studied originally art history.
I got out of art school, and then, of course, it's the idea of going out and finding a job is kind of dismal. And I said, well, I do graduate work, and I thought I would. And living in, I don't know how to quite express this, but in Southern California, south in San Diego, and you told anybody you were an artist, they looked at you, you're like some exotic flower. Mm-hmm. What's that? So I never said that. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, obviously then I can't be an artist. I'll have to be something dignified and be a college professor and teach art or, write about art. So I went to Berkeley and did graduate work in art history, and I thought I might actually want to be an art, write about art. Mm. And then I stopped art history, and I know exactly the moment I stopped. At 3 o'clock at night, I was memorizing Roman coins. I said, I don't want to do this.
But that sort of, in a way, that takes me to. I'm afraid I didn't get to see your show in Nîmes in, I think it's 2005, my partner Patricia did, and she brought back the catalogue. And there was a page in the catalogue where you've several pages of things like artist's notebook material. But there was a very nice a few pages where you indexed the way that it sort of almost harkened back to that sort of obsessive indexing that presumably you did as an art historian or as a student, or trying to make sense of the world and all this information that, like Roman coins. But if I just read some of these, this is how John presumably filed his photographic material that you sourced, some of your, presumably your montages and so on. For example, under A, John's got listed attack, animals, animal man, above, automobiles left, automobiles right. And under D, he's got dwarf, death, division, door, etc. And it just goes on and on and on like this. I mean, can you talk a bit about the way that the process of selection of images, of the pairings of, or the binaries and things that happen in...
Pretty broad question, but let me give it a try here. First of all, accumulating photographs, you're trying some way to keep them sorted and where I could access them. And so I developed, I'd look at it and say, try to think of some key word that, that if I had to find it, I could find access it. And eventually I gave that up because, as you would surmise, that any photograph, you could file it maybe, 100 different ways under any category according to what's in the photograph. So I gave that up. And so that's the first part of your question. And then the second part of your question, help me again.
I'm not sure, actually. What you're saying that. But I mean, some of the things I've read about you, some of the writers have talked about you in connection with Eisenstein in terms of montage and so on. Mm-hmm. But also, I read someone made quite a good point about typage, in terms of going back to movies again, about sort of typecasting of characters. So presumably you have, you've. I know it's a bit like trying to explain a joke or something, talking about this sort of thing, but it's sort of pointless. But in a way, but by these sort of taxonomies, are you sort of typecasting? Do you think?
Or, probably because I'm looking at a photograph of people that I've never seen before, and somebody that looks like the criminal type, so you're probably just a sweetheart. You're probably like somebody casting for a movie. I'm doing something similar, and then working with those stereotypes and maybe trying to convince you otherwise, or using it as raw material,
I mean, sometimes you do it with shapes. I mean, for example, I forgot the title for a moment, but with the snake, the piece with the snake, where you create a frame, and it's always clear in the title what you're doing. You make a frame from, say, the outline of someone holding a python, which creates a strange shape, and then you use that as a...
I think the easiest way to understand me, and for me to understand myself, I often said that, I think of myself as a writer, and then instead of using words, I'm using images, but I'm kind of building in the same way. And to go on with that analogy, say if a writer can get the right word following the right word, there's a kind of correctness or rightness about it. There's a kind of tautness. If it's not right, then it's too loose and it's too obvious association. If it's too far afield, then doesn't work either, but you're just getting the right kind of collision. And so I think I go at it that way, and you're right about Eisenstein or whatever, and I think in this essay in the catalog, my old student, David Sally, compares me to Godard, and I had said to him that he's the only artist to look at right now. And I did go back and look at Godard again, and I can see what he was getting at because of the, unexpected collisions or the connections of sound and image that don't make any connection and so on, and really playing with your expectations and then going against that somehow and playing with your mind in some way. Sure.
With the sort of, because initially with some of the earlier work it was just text, and going back to the art history thing, sorry to harken back to that, but with the pieces that were you using text of Greenberg or Max Kozloff or Barbara Rose and so on. They're sort of straight takes from that text, and you're using...
They're direct lifts from text, sure.
So it's not like Jasper Johns' The Critic Sees. It's not that's quite... That comes across as extremely angry, overtly angry to me. I mean, that's how it's my reading of that piece, or The Critic Speaks, those pieces. But with you, you just show, apparently, you're just showing a
Just one?
Sorry, just representing.
Well, yeah, and with the idea, I mean, you know, those, let's say at the time, those were three, let's say, prevalent attitudes or ideas about how to think about art, and you know how they've stood up over time, and we'll see.
Because I mean, just going backwards and forwards here with my card system, but with. It sort of takes me on the something that I detect sometimes, a sort of East Coast, West Coast thing, that that West Coast artists maybe, it seems, looking at your CV, that a lot of your career initially, you seem to, I mean, obviously you were showing in the States, but you it really took off in Europe. And there seems to have been some resistance from East Coast artists to the West Coast artists early on. I mean,
resistance is too polite a word.
Yeah, but. Yeah. Well, can I read you?
How about?
I have actually got one from Lawrence Weiner, but I'm not sure I'll use it. But from Joseph Kossuth, that I assume was written sort of in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And he says, although the amusing pot paintings of John Baldessari allude to this sort of work being conceptual cartoons of actual conceptual art, they are not really relevant to this discussion. And it seems like you've hit a raw nerve with.
Sounds like it.
You know. I mean, but is it that they thought that you, because also words like pop. It's probably, we don't think of this now, but it was quite recently that people sort of took Warhol really seriously, and the pop was used almost as a sort of pejorative term, and to apply it to your work, which you could say some of your work on the surface of it looks like pop, you know, it's sort of using popular images, but it looked a bit like Rauschenberg.
Yeah, well, that's a tough one, you know, because here we're talking about categories and how you understand a category. Klaus Oldenburg, a very good friend, and Roy Lichtenstein was a very good friend. And on both different occasions, I had referred to them in conversation to pop artists, and they just looked at me and said, I'm not a pop artist, I'm an artist.
And it's like you've said somewhere about not being entirely comfortable about being called a conceptual artist either.
Categories only make sense. I mean, for instance, you know, if I ask you to name some Impressionist artists, you'd probably start with Monet, and then maybe.
But he's not really.
And it works for a while, you know, when something begins to emerge, and for journalists, they have to put things in a basket somehow. But then, as it goes on, you know, you can see that each artist is quite different.
But when going back to your father owning this movie theatre, that there's a sort of an element with someone like, say, Warhol looking at movie stars and everything. It's different to you, although as a first generation American, but living in, like most people probably, in LA and Hollywood, it's something that is just absolutely around you. You know, the movie business as subject matter and so on.
Yeah, easy connection too, I think. I mean, let's say if my studio was in a plumbing supply house, and they'd say, "Oh, yeah, well, the influence in plumbing on us are."
But maybe more from the point of view of the fact that you're just in, you know, that you lived in California, as something that the proximity to it that you could find images.
Yeah, that's I don't know why. Anyway, don't get me started on this. the idea that somehow the surroundings influence the artist.
Well, but
let me give you an example here. Years ago, you know, Casper Koenig rather, did the show called Viscounts. Probably are familiar with. And I was there, and he said, "John, I want to show you where your work is. I put you together in kind of a California section with Bruce Nauman and Bob Irwin." And I said, fine with one. But I got to tell you right now, there's a big show of Los Angeles artists at LA County Museum, and I'm not in it. So much for, you know, Los Angeles or California art, you see. In his mind, I was more a European artist.
But it's I mean, I think that's interesting, because there's this thing also about the Hollywood's attitude to it being, just talking about movies as an aside, but it being a an industry there rather than this idea of the auteur that the European
it's no longer cinema in Hollywood. I'm sorry.
But I mean, even back in sort of the high watermark of sort of auteurism.
It's big business. That's what it is. Yeah.
But John, can I ask you a bit about teaching? Because that was where I was going when I was sort of asking about kicking off with the cremation project.
Yeah.
Was that? I mean, I know it's something you're asked all the time, and you've taught so many artists and. You know, you taught from, was it 1970 to 88 or something like that? So you taught for a long time at Carl's.
I taught some, getting out of school since 1957. And may preface anything you're going to say about me as a teacher by saying, I only did it to make a living.
Yeah, sure. But I think it's interesting.
There's nothing noble about it.
There's quite a few people here doing the same thing, but they're not making a living. But... But you say that, which is very self-deprecating way. But actually, you did turn it into a degree. You sort of turned it into a way of making work by working. You work.
Well, first of all, in life you need a job, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you got to pay the bills, have a roof over your head, and food, and so on. And I tried various things and. Teaching seemed the time passed the fastest, and that's what you wanted to happen. Plus, you wanted to be somewhat interested in it, teaching art not so bad, you get the summers off, so you can work. That's not so bad either, and a salary it's okay, you can live, and then I thought selfishly, just so I could get through the day better, I would try to make the teaching kind of like a creative thing for I mean, it would be having fun. And then I figured if I was having fun, the students would probably be having fun also. So it was probably a good equation. I guess that basically is it. Yeah.
Because I mean, there are certain works that you obviously had access to. Equipment in order to, maybe make video pieces or things like that and so on. I'm trying to think of was Baldessari Sings LeWitt, was that a piece that you made?
I was teaching, I guess, University of California, San Diego. I left in 70 when CalArt started in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. I was the original faculty there. And that's when the Sony Porter Pack came out. So it was a lot of artists got interested in using it because it became accessible. And Cal